Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hey, thank you for all of you who've gone on iTunes and either subscribed or, even better yet, left positive comments, because this is kind of a new thing for us to get actually positive comments. We are actually recording this on Valentine's Day, joined by two of our favorite guests, Rick Wilson and Molly Jong Fast. Thank you for taking time out on Valentine's Day to talk to me.
Well, thank you, Charlie. I appreciate that. Yeah. Good to be back with you.
All right, first question. Is Valentine's Day like a real holiday, or is it a totally commercial bullshit holiday that is just designed to get guys in trouble? Molly, I'm just going to throw that to you.
Wait, why can't Rick get that one first?
Because he doesn't know the answer to it. Only women understand the answer to this. See, all men, you know, fall into the trap of thinking maybe it's just a bullshit commercial holiday, and that's how they get in trouble.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I mean, you know, I think Valentine's Day is one of those holidays that matters more when you're I have no answer for this question.
Okay, all right. So, Rick,
I'm sorry, Charlie.
Rick, had you broken the code on this though earlier?
So look, what I've been told is that what women want for Valentine's Day, they want to see pictures of your junk.
Yeah.
They want to see your elaborate new tattoos. And they want to talk about your favorite sporting event. So those are the three things, what I've been told, at least. Okay. I could be wrong.
So Rick, should you disclose at this point that you are now doing PR for Brett Favre?
Well played.
See, this is why I brought it up, because I figured that there would be something there. Okay, so we have so much to talk about. It's hard to know where to begin on a day like this. And let's start with my sense of a lot of Trump skeptical conservatives who are freaking out, because for the last couple of years, we've been talking about conservatives losing their mind, talking about, you know, what's happening to the Republican Party. And in the last week, there's this sense like, oh my God, are the Democrats going to blow this by going with their id as well? And you're starting to see some of the hardcore. I mean, I'm seeing Jennifer Rubin suggesting that they're going too far. Max Boot is getting concerned that maybe the Democrats are going off the reservation. I see Tom Nichols tweeting that, you know, he would vote for anybody other than Trump, but he's already exhausted by liberals. So where are you at right now, Rick Wilson, watching the Democrats take positions that, shall we say, are not necessarily in the mainstream? And Molly, you can push back on that in just a second.
You know, Charlie, I wrote about this in my book, and which comes out on paperback on February 26th, available at all fine retailers. I wrote about this in my book. Democrats always seek political death. They always will pick the singular strategy that will burn themselves to the ground. They always pick out a cluster of issues that no one gives a shit about in the real world. They pick out these boutique issues in a Walmart nation, and they find themselves saying, well, I don't understand. We led with gun control, climate change, and gender equality for bathrooms. Why didn't we win in rural Arkansas? Why didn't we pick up seats in ass crack West Virginia? Well, the reason is they always follow their own impulses. And Democrats win when they take a deep breath. Like last year, there was a great motivation to run a lot of Democratic campaigns centered around the cluster of issues that, you know, stoke the happy spot of Democratic activists. And so they're like, Parkland will change everything. That'll be the centerpiece of our campaign. The campaigns that really did well ran on healthcare.
Right.
They ran on things like, you're getting screwed by the economy. You think it's good, but your college debt is still out there. You're not doing as well as the people who scored big in the tax code changes, in hedge funds. The Democrats' campaigns that actually also allowed them to have some ideological variability. So, you know, I know everybody's in love with AOC, but the bigger story was that Democrats like Connor Lamb went out and won in places where Republicans should have won. The bigger story, you had a Democrat talking about tax cuts in Orange County who won a Republican seat.
Okay, now they seem to be in the process of ignoring all of those lessons.
Correct. They, the Democrats only learn when they touch the hot stove. Okay, they win when they win with stunt casting or when they win with somebody who's got like an amazing natural talent. Look, Barack Obama, amazing natural talent in 2008. People writing books that we're going to have a 40-year Democratic reign after Barack Obama won and permanently altered the political culture. Well, 2 years later, guys like me said, huh, well, we're going to go out and run a whole ton of super PAC ads about this Obamacare thing because it is not popular and people do not like it and they associate it with this guy. So, you know, the difficulty we always get in with you know, trying to help our friends on the other side of the aisle is that they want to run the campaigns that are in their heads, not the ones that are in front of them. And I've said this a million times and I've admitted this a million times. It's not that guys like me are all a bunch of political super geniuses who are like in a laboratory somewhere out thinking the Democrats. 95% of the time, they just hand us the issue and they give us the sword to cut off their head. and there's a good chance that they're going to enable Donald Trump to win in 2020. Let me tell you, I don't care what you think of Ilhan, what you think of the Ilhan, a grown up Democratic majority, would have summoned her to Nancy Pelosi's office and said, "You are young and very promising. Shut the fuck up."
Mm-hmm. But you don't think that happened?
Oh, I do think it happened. I don't think she listened. I don't think she listened.
Right.
And this is another thing about the Democratic Party is, you know, the cat herding of the Democratic Party is a very large and fractious group of people, and they don't like to be told what to do. But, you know, sometimes discipline is the role of a party leader, and discipline is something that lets you present a public image that wins people outside of your base.
Okay, so Molly, give me your sense, because the good news, and I think I said this on the podcast yesterday with Josh, the good news, of course, is this is taking place in February, the year before the election, as opposed to in the election. But clearly, this is shaping that the Republicans do not want the 2020 election to be a referendum up or down on Donald Trump, because they lose that. But if they can make it into this binary choice between, yes, Trump is awful, but the Democrats have become socialists. They become the party of socialism, late-term abortion, open borders, and crime, sort of like what Richard Nixon ran on. You know, the Democrats were acid, amnesty, and abortion. So
I think the problem with Democrats is that we just don't ideologically get in line the way Republicans do. So you have and the Democratic Party is bigger, but it's more fractured. So we have people, you know, under this tent, we have people who are like very far left and believe, you know, like, you know, Glenn Greenwald types. And then we have, if you appear on Tucker Carlson every night, then you're probably not a Democrat. But, I mean, it just encompasses a lot of different views. And so we get into a lot of trouble that way. I also just think things just sort of got out of hand. We won a lot of seats. A lot of people felt empowered. They got a little bit ahead of their skis. I mean, I think there's a way to take it back. Again, though, it's really, really scary. And Republicans are just so much better at messaging.
Well, as Rick points out, you're making it easy. It really is easy. I mean, I am not a political consultant, but I pretty much know the ads that I would run. It does seem, though, this seems so familiar to me, and I'm sure it does to Rick as well, watching the Democrats. It feels like what the Republicans went through over the last couple of years. You have the hardcore true believers, the AOCs, but they're not necessarily the real problem. It's the inability and unwillingness of everyone else to stand up to them. It's just sort of like, we need to go along. And if conservatives attack them, then we must defend them because they're being attacked.
You know,
Charlie, that instinct. Go ahead, Rick.
That's exactly on point. And one of the things that, you know, I've always, you know, notice about the Republican Party is, you know, they're all afraid of the mean tweet. They're all afraid of Donald Trump saying, you know, weak, you know, sad rhino cuck so-and-so is, you know, unacceptable. But you know what? The Democrats are now utterly petrified that AOC is going to put them on blast on Twitter. And you know, if we end up with both parties being driven by the mean girls theory of of you know, what prescribes their behavior is fear of social media, then, you know, we're going to be in this, both parties are going to be in this self-reinforcing spiral into, you know, into catering to the edges, not to the center. And, you know, as much as we have ideological silos in this country right now, we still live in a large, diverse nation where there are a whole spectrum of behaviors and beliefs in various places that are not reflected accurately just on woke right. Twitter or on
right.
Reddit.
Right.
Okay. Let me throw out a theory that is just a theory, and feel free to reject it. I know that the conventional wisdom is that Howard Schultz is a spoiler who would reelect Donald Trump, and that of course may be true. We're in February of 2019. Right. But if in fact the Democrats go with a Green New Deal late term abortion candidate, and by the way, I'm just doing that as
Tulsi Gabbard.
Wait, yes, right. Okay, yeah. that I know yeah. a lot of voters in places like Wisconsin who are just going to who will not disagree with anything that we say about Donald Trump, who will go, you know what, I can't vote for that candidate. I'm just going to vote for Trump. It's a binary choice. But if there is a rational centrist candidate there, rather than voting for Trump, they might basically say a pox on both your houses. So I'm not completely convinced at this moment that Schultz would draw votes away from the Democrats. I think he might also draw votes from so-called reluctant Trump voters. And of course, having been wrong so often in the past, I could be wrong again. What do you think, Rick?
I think there's some merit to that argument, because I don't think we've seen what we've seen so far with Schultz is this kind of rough start rollout.
Right.
We haven't seen the results of, you know, what happens if Howard Schultz decides to spend some money. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what you see on cable TV interviews shapes opinions and attitudes. But if a guy like that decides to go up on TV and go digital and start pounding out a message that's more, you know, targeted, he could probably peel off some of these folks that are in the you know, the more closer to the middle lane of the Trump reluctant lane or the reform lane, whatever you want to call it. But it is. And look, if the Democrats nominate, you know, Dr. Atheist Von Gay, the celebrity abortionist vegan, you know, it's not.
This
it's
could
not
happen.
Gonna be, no. It's not going to be the same political landscape as if they nominated, you know, Joe Biden or Cory Booker or any. Well, maybe Cory Booker. He's, yeah. But
so I have this paranoid sort of it's paranoid, but I think it might I think there might be something there. What if Howard Schultz is and I could be really I'm setting myself up to possibly be very wrong. But what if he's trying to push Democrats' hand to nominate a more centrist candidate?
I think I don't know what that's his intention at this point, but if that is the effect at the end of the day, if the Democrats become so concerned about Howard Schultz that it becomes an argument, let's go with somebody who can actually win a general right. election, then that would be a good thing.
Right.
But if it means that they nominate an Amy Klobuchar instead of a Tulsi Gabbard,
yep.
You know, again, you know, and I know Democrats hate this and Republicans hate this too. But as many times as Republicans said that Barack Obama was a, you know, socialist Marxist Kenyan sleeper agent, mm-hmm. You know, he actually ran as kind of a fairly center lane technocratic Democrat, you know, guy in 2008. He wasn't trying to scare the shit out of people.
Right.
And you know, Bill Clinton was for all of his for all his moral failings, Bill Clinton was absolutely a centrist and absolutely a technocrat. And in both of those cases, you know, those are the two major successful contemporary Democratic campaign models. You know, neither one of them was running to ban meat to ground all the airplanes and to have a 5-year plan that includes government control of the beet harvest.
Do you think did that get leaked on purpose or by accident?
Oh, I think leadership just shanked her.
Yeah.
Just stuck the knife in. Because you know what? The other part of it is if you're going to have a plan, if you're going to have a sweeping plan that's this gigantic aspirational goal, make sure it's tight. Make sure it's scored. Make sure it's edited. Make sure it's not going to immediately expose you to infinite ridicule.
And literally none of that happened.
And then to have Gavin Newsom, like, the next day be like, we're not doing the high-speed train. Felt like a sort of coordinated effort.
Yeah, it felt like somebody was called to the headmaster's office and told, or the headmistress's office and told, this isn't how we play here.
I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. It was the right decision. I mean, this was the ultimate boondoggle, that high speed train, and why folks have made high speed trains into an article of faith. It was really puzzled me. We had a big fight in Wisconsin about this for a train that would go between Milwaukee and sort of close to Madison, and it would go a maximum of 70 miles an hour. So we called it not a fast train, but a half fast train, which, because I'm 12 years old on the radio, I would pronounce as the half ass train. And it became one of the key issues in the 2010 election that elected Scott Walker, when people realized what a waste of money. And nobody thought, really seriously thought, that it was going to change the economy or was going to slow down climate change, that you build this, you know, vastly expensive technological plaything.
Well, also, the trains in America are terrible. So, I mean, if you imagine taking Amtrak to L.A., it's like a death sentence.
Okay, so I want a little more on the presidential race, because you, Molly, the reason we have you on today is because you are one of the six people in America that can actually pronounce the name of the mayor of
South Bend, Indiana.
Okay,
Pete Buttigieg.
Okay, Rick, can you say it?
Buttigieg?
Buttigieg, right?
Buttigieg. I think ditch is a crucial part of it.
Buttigieg.
The second part's a B, a D, not a B.
D. Yeah.
I could be wrong. I mean,
Buttigieg. So the mayorship of South Bend, you know, has long been known as the cradle of presidents. He's getting a little bit of attention, and I'm so now, Molly, you know, you kind of got a thing for him.
Yeah, I like him a lot.
I mean, why?
I love a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah.
And
he's like
veteran.
18 years old, though, right? I mean,
what?
He's like 18 years old.
He's 38.
Okay.
I think he's setting himself up for something other than president, like vice president. But I could see him very, you know, what's cool about him is he's like gay, but that's not who he is. You know, he's just like anyone else who's married. But he's the mayor, and he's Rhodes Scholar, and he is a veteran, and it's real equality. You know, he just has a marriage like anyone else.
Yeah, and he does seem to be in the centrist lane in this campaign. He's sort of still doing a little bit of the tap dancing, but he's clearly not coming out basically saying, yes, it's time for a vegan president and all of this sort of thing, and, you know, getting people off airplanes and all the stuff that Rick was just talking about. He seems to be running as a pragmatist.
Well, he's also from the heartland. You know, he's from the center. I mean, he's been in, you know, and also he's, I mean, the stuff he has to say about Pence is really, because Pence was his governor, is really hair turning. I mean, his description of Pence as like an insane religious zealot
he's not a fan of Pence, is he?
No,
I mean, that's that will give him, I mean, that'll give him a certain amount of traction. Okay, so the president, as we are speaking, and this could be obsolete by the time people listen to it, is reportedly going to sign that government closure deal, which is a complete humiliating surrender on the wall. I don't think there's any other rational way of looking at that. So, Rick, it really is an exceptionally interesting moment where he's on the phone with his normal media sycophants saying this is really not that bad. He's got to talk the Lou Dobbses and the Sean Hannitys down. But in part, it's because the guy has no cards left. He is the world's worst negotiator. And I'm guessing at some point he's trying to communicate them that it was just not going to get any better. I mean, so give me your capsule take on the complete defeat of Donald Trump on his signature issue.
Well, I mean, President Soy Cuckerson has utterly rolled over for the caravan hordes coming to murder us all. You know, obviously, unless he was willing to burn down the government in order to ensure that these brown Avengers couldn't cross our insecure borders and take jobs and rape our pets, then, you know, he's betraying America. And by doing so, he was offered in the White House last year around this time a $25 billion deal with the actual language that said he could build a wall. And because he's the author of the chart of the deal, the worst negotiator in history, tells us how not to do it. He ended up with $1.37 billion, all of which a fraction will be there to put fencing up in areas mostly that already have fencing. These are like fence repairs. This is the greatest capitulation in presidential history. Nancy took him to the cleaners. I mean, he went in there with, on his best day in this negotiation, could have gotten $25 billion out of the deal, walked away with nothing.
But you know,
and the reason they walked away with nothing is it comes down to one simple thing. It's President Stephen Miller. And President Stephen Miller said, absolutely not. No how, no way. We're doing a deal for DACA because these are anchor babies coming here to brown America. And so, you know, President Miller and Vice President Coulter and the rest, they won that battle a year ago, and it is never going to get better for them. It's never going to – the situation will never improve. I mean, I joke about this all the time, but by the end there will be like a ditch or a berm in the desert, and that will be it.
Yes, but we're also now in the emperor has new clothes phase of this, where Donald Trump will stand in front of the berm and he will say that it is the biggest, most beautiful wall ever, and that he did it, and the wall in fact was built. It is sort of the ultimate gaslight. Given the fact that he's a serial fabulist and that he does this rather naturally, this may actually work for him. Right? To say, I'm finishing the wall. I'm building the wall. It's almost done.
Did you see during that rally when Brad Parscale got up there to teach the crowd the new chant?
Yes.
Which is continue building the wall?
And they went along, right? I mean, it was like finish the wall. It's, you know.
It took a long time for them to catch on.
And we have always been at war with Eurasia. Always been at war. We really have.
We're going to finish the space elevator, the wall, and the moon base all in the next couple of weeks. They're all ready to go. I mean, it's all practically done.
Okay, so biggest story of the week, obviously, the death of Lyndon LaRouche.
Oh my God! Good riddance.
I'm
not to speak ill of the dead, but fuck that guy.
I have a muted reaction to this because I always thought he was already dead. But it does occur to me though that the tragedy of Lyndon LaRouche is that he was born too early because this is his age. This is what we are living in Lyndon LaRouche's America. If he would have just, waited 20 years or so, he would be giving, he would be the keynote speaker at CPAC. He'd be standing there with Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens and Molly's good friend Seb Gorka. He would be bigger than Alex Jones.
Yes.
He might have even won the New Hampshire primary. Who knows?
Charlie, you couldn't be more right. Because, look, if you regurgitated Lyndon LaRouche into the QAnon feed, those people would be like, yeah, that's it. We're finally showing the global elite reptilians who's boss.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct.
I mean, in his era, they would just have, you know, your crackpots standing on street corners with badly made posters. And now he could be on
Queen
social
media. Queen of England is a dope dealer.
Exactly.
He ran as a Democrat. He was a Democrat?
Yeah, he was a lefty at one point, then a righty. And who the
Yeah, he was all over the board, Molly. There was never really – look, the most generous interpretation of Lyndon LaRouche was it was an epic 40-year grift. That's the most generous. But the reality is the guy was a conspiracist, and we live in the age of where kook conspiracies have been completely mainstream.
Yeah, that is my point. I think one of you tweeted out, or both of you tweeted out, the poster from CPAC, the kinds of people that are being featured, and it is we are living in the golden age of grifting. And some of these folks, I mean, you have Candace Owens. She could be doing this for another 50, 60, 70 years, you know?
Sure.
I think she'll end up going left eventually.
Well, she was left.
Yeah, but I think she'll come back and she'll say, I've seen the error of my ways. Trumpism is terrible. When the parties shift, or when she stops getting attention for this, I think she'll go back.
I think there may be a lot of that. There are a lot of folks where you realize that they, well, first of all, they're allergic to ideas.
Right.
The thing about the Charlie Kirks and the Candace Owens of the world is they're basically just kind of a series of bumper stickers, a series of slogans. And that once you like even scratch the surface, you realize you have no idea what you're talking about. Like her, the deep analysis that, well, you know, the word national socialist includes the word socialist, which means the Nazis were socialists. And of course, then people come back. Well, what about the word nationalist? In that, well, no. The fact that the word nationalist has nothing to do with who they are. So this word defines who they are, and it's just like you don't know any history. You've never thought about this. You have no idea.
Ideas and history, Charlie.
Exactly.
And you know, the best case scenario for a guy like Charlie Kirk is he's going to end up, you know, with some gig on Fox for a couple of years, and you know, do a lot of golf outings.
Yeah, could be like a Matt Gaetz.
Could be. So,
you know, there's an argument, you know, and when Matt Gaetz, you know, Matt Gaetz said the quiet part loud.
Right.
He said that he wants to be the Republican AOC.
Oh God, yeah.
Right.
Look, a lot of these guys, they want to play this game of, I want to be the provocateur. I want to be the person that's like the next Limbaugh or whatever, the next person to burn stuff down and causes, you know, all this controversy. And Candace and Tammy and all these other people, they want to be the next Ann Coulter.
Right.
And you know, who knows what Charlie Kirk wants to be, but
Ann
they're
Coulter
gonna they're
at the law degree.
Okay, yeah. So Rick, I think I know what the answer to this is. So Rick Wilson, who do you want to be the next? You want to be the next who?
Who do I want to be? Do I want to be the next?
Yeah.
Oh hell! Well, I mean, look, I can tell you in my heart of hearts.
Yeah.
Except for the like.
Other than Brett Favre.
Look, I'm perfectly okay if I end up somewhere in the lesser Hunter Thompson role.
Okay. See, what I thought you were going to say
the
was
backyard,
that you're
in the middle of the night, naked, shooting guns. Hell yeah, that sounds like a fine plan.
I figured I've gotten to the point in life where I'm not thinking I want to be the next so and so. I'm like pretty happy being me. This is not my goal. But you just know these folks are sitting out there going, I want that cable gig, or I want to be Jared's best friend. And I don't even want to go into that. I'm about to go into a dangerous area with Jared. Speaking of grifters.
Wait, why?
And I can't. So speaking of grifters, Molly.
Yeah.
Who is Hard Rock Nick?
I think Hard Rock Nick must be like born of the MAGA movement. Like this type of sort of super misogynist that believes, I mean, he's like very red pilled, but he's old. He's not one of those sort of young red pilled guys.
Okay. So why are we talking about him? Tell our listeners who he is.
We should never. He's a guy with lots of tattoos who was sort of discovered the last couple of weeks as being like hilariously arrogant for no reason. And then I and various other bad people on the internet made him more famous, and now he, you know, but he's also, I mean, I've been sent like all day, I get sent people sending me like legal documents of his. I've seen his bankruptcy. I've seen his someone sent me, I don't even want to tell you the stuff I've been sent to. I saw his driver's license, I saw his name change. Somebody sent me, he married this very beautiful woman and then he stalked her and he pooped in her sink. I mean, he's a really sketchy guy. And then I've also
That's a great Valentine's Day story.
Nothing shows love like pooping in a sink.
And I've also seen, I mean, I can't even say the stuff people have sent me, but if somebody hacks my DMs, they will be really, they'll be sorry.
All right, so this is why This is why we all ought to quit. Twitter. Okay, one last question here. I just got to throw out. So, Rick Wilson, Paul Manafort, Paul Manafort, who I heard somebody, you know, it was asked the question, why is he lying, given all of the threats that he faces of having to spend the rest of his life in jail? And the most charitable explanation is he just can't help himself. He's just a chronic liar, but. It is one of the strangest stories how this guy has managed to just, I mean, he's been a criminal for decades, and I think we're now realizing that. But why do you think Paul Manafort is doing what he's doing?
Because he doesn't want to die of poisoning by the Russians if he tells the truth. So he's caught in the horns of a real dilemma, Charlie. Mm-hmm. If he tells the truth about his connections and the contacts and the conspiracy with the Russians, they'll kill him. It's what happens to people that screw with the Russians. They get killed. And he knows that. He's been around these people. Remember, he, in Ukraine, worked for the guy who poisoned his opponent with dioxin. This is not a pleasant individual. He understands who these people are. He understands that the people up the chain from him, Semyon and Deripaska and all those other people, will kill him if he speaks the truth.
You know, I was going to go with that he's still just hanging on the possibility of a pardon from Donald Trump, which I think is somewhat sketchy. To rely on Donald Trump's personal loyalty is always a bad bet. But what you are arguing is just as plausible, because there's no reasonable explanation. There's no simple reasonable explanation, right?
Look, Paul Manafort in the timeline where the Russians aren't a threat, flips, gets 2 years, comes out, writes a book, mm-hmm. goes on the speaking circuit the remainder of his days. Maybe he's not buying ostrich jackets at that point, but he's not eating prison loaf and looking at the walls of a cell for 20 hours a day.
And the fact that he's blown that up is the amazing thing, isn't it?
He's definitely scared.
But they all think they're too clever, okay? Roger Stone thinks he's smarter than Mueller, and Manafort thinks he's smarter than Mueller, but none of these guys are smarter than Mueller. None of these guys are smart enough to hack this equation on a real, you know, get out of jail free basis. They're all screwed in that regard.
So Mueller may be the second smartest man in America then. Of course, Jared being the smartest. So
the ambassador of everything. In Jared's case, I wrote recently, I think it was for you guys, about all these Trump like wannabes and hangers on who hang out at the hotel and drinking $40 cocktails and hoping to see Jared. A lobbyist friend of mine who is one of my MAGAs in disguise, he plays the MAGA game, but is, you know, he's serving his clients. Amoral, but you know, lobbyist.
Right.
That goes without saying.
Yeah. He goes, I hosted a dinner there a few weeks ago. And he said, there are literally people who have their interns staked out outside to see if Jared's car pulls up, or if Ivanka pulls up, or if Eric Jr. or Don Jr. or Eric is coming in, so they can warn them and prepare them so they can get a drink sent to them and all this.
How swampy slash pathetic is that?
It's Banana Republic.
It is Banana Republic.
Well, it's like white trash Bogota 1990. It's awful. There's nothing redeeming about the corruption there.
No, but we might have
the
another.
The kids are really dumb, which I think is something.
Except for Jared. Boy genius. And you know what? When he wins the Nobel Peace Prize, you guys are going to be sorry. You guys. But hey, listen, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much. Rick Wilson, Molly Jong Fast, and thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we won't do this all over again, but we'll do something all over again. All right.